From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, you're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. North Carolina's primary election is underway. This is the chance for voters to decide which party nominees compete in the November election. Early voting runs through February 29th, and Election Day is March 3rd. Voters in North Carolina are deciding yes on candidates for president, U.S. House and Senate races, as well as state House and Senate candidates. They're also choosing the people who will have more direct impacts on their lives, from county commissioners to school board members. This year, a voter ID requirement does not apply to the primary. You do not need an ID to vote in this election. Now, a second court has temporarily blocked the North Carolina law requiring voter ID on the grounds that it discriminates against African American voters. According to the Washington Post, this latest ruling, handed down by a state court of appeals February 18th, means it's even less likely that voters will need an ID in time for the November election. Today, we're taking a look at the races on the local ballots and the issues driving those races. Ben Schachtman, managing editor of Port City Daily, joins me now. Ben Schachtman, welcome back to Coastline.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. And of course, if you have a question about the primary, and we've already gotten a couple of those, just about some basic mechanics, or if you'd like to tell us why you're voting in the primary or why you're not, you can call us during the live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Ben Schachtman of Port City Daily, we will get into some of these mechanics that people have been confused about this time around. But first of all, what are you hearing about the issues that people are connecting to the March primary, the reasons that they're going to the polls or not?
So lately, obviously, there's been a lot of talk about the hospital. It's the elephant in the room.
New Hanover Regional Medical Center.
Yes. And there's also been the sort of rapidly evolving story of WAVE, or the Cape Fear Public Transit Authority, which has gone through some financial troubles and then a sort of board overhaul. And it's tricky to know how exactly that will land in the election, just because, you know, right now we have an interim board and we really don't have a clear idea of what the authority is going to look like over the next couple of months. But
and a lot of these issues, like water quality also in both Brunswick and New Hanover counties, and the predators that seem to be popping up on a weekly basis in the New Hanover County school system, these are really important issues for voters. But what do they mean in terms of how people are going to vote?
So we can actually look at the school board, and we look at the county's board of commissioners here in New Hanover County. And there are a lot of people running to get into office for the Board of Commissioners. And there's actually one guy running to get out of office for the Board of Education. There aren't a lot of people running, and there are a bunch of open seats. I believe there are actually three current board members in the Board of Education who are leaving. Chairwoman Lisa Estep, Vice Chair David Wortman, and I believe Jeanette Nichols. All of their terms are up in 2020, and none of them are running for re-election. So there's three open seats. So usually you expect to see a lot of candidates. It's what we saw in 2018. We saw a really wide field. And this year, not so much. I'm curious to see, you know, what those
really wide field for the New Hanover County Board of Education.
Yes, in 2018.
Right.
This year,
but
not so much.
But this year, it's pretty narrow.
It's pretty narrow.
And you also mentioned there's a guy who's running to get out of office. You are, of course, referring to Bill Rivenbark.
Yes. So, you know, and if hypothetically, if Rivenbark were to, you know, go through the primary,
He's on the, just to be clear, he's on the New Hanover County Board of Education right now. His term is not up.
Yes, yeah, it's in the middle of his term, yeah.
But he is running as a Republican for the New Hanover County Board of Commissioners.
Yes. And so if he were to win that election, he would then be on the Board of Commissioners, and the Board of Education would then have to, get someone else on that board. And there's a whole state statute process for doing that. They basically appoint a replacement to fill out the rest of his term. And it's sort of a no-risk scenario for him, because if he does not succeed, either in the primary or the general election, he can then remain on the Board of Education for the next 2 years. But it's interesting to me that he chose now as the time to run for a county commissioner.
Port City Daily, how are you handling the election coverage this year? What are you covering? Because we had to have kind of an internal discussion about what we're going to do, how much we're going to do versus the November election.
Sure. So for the general election, that's the one in November, we will cover Pender County, New Hanover County, and Brunswick County. And we had a little bit of that weight taken off of our shoulders for the primary election because there's fewer races. There's a lot of people who are, it's either going to come down to one Democratic and one Republican candidate, or sometimes a three-way race with a third-party candidate, or we have people who are running unopposed. So we got the chance to really focus on the races that had a lot of action for the primary races, like the Board of Commissioners race here in New Hanover County, some of the school board races across the river in Brunswick County, and some of the state races, like District 19 and I believe District 20.
And that's exactly what WHQR's news team is doing as well. And you can find election coverage from both organizations at portcitydaily.com and whqr.org. I've been hearing people asking about where is the information about the candidates. So that, for us at WHQR, is going up on our website. Now, voter turnout in primaries is notoriously low, except when it gets a bump in presidential years. So far, what are we seeing on that front? Is this bump expected to happen in the primary?
Well, I think you had actually looked at some of the numbers, and you'd seen 3,000 people?
3,000 people, a little less, have voted so far in New Hanover County. Yeah, it's hard to say. Unaffiliated voters have voted largely Democratic so far.
Yeah, that's an interesting part of this, too. I just wanted to touch on real quick is that some people didn't realize this. So primaries are usually seen as, you know, stalwart party members' chance to pick their own candidates. So if you're a Democrat, this is your chance to pick which Democrat is going to go to the big race or vice versa, or for the same for the Republican. But in these primary races, unaffiliated voters get a chance to kind of weigh in on either side.
And it's interesting, too, that unaffiliated voters outnumber Republicans and Democrats in New Hanover County. That's sort of an interesting trend that seems to be happening.
So they have a really significant voice in these elections. And I also think that those same voters, even if they ultimately choose to vote Republican, I think they'll also head to the polls because of this, the overwhelming interest in the Democratic presidential primary. And of course, this is all on the same ballot. So that drives people to the polls.
Right. And let's just, you know, I have to say on my way in, anecdotally, I met someone, asked them if they had voted in the primary or were planning on it. And he said, well, I'd like to do my duty, but didn't really know much about the issues. So going back to, since we kind of started picking at the New Hanover County Public Schools issue, why is there so much turmoil on the Board of Education right now?
I think, and this is from, you know, what we've seen publicly and some of the conversations I've had off the record, I think there is not a unanimous point of view on how much of the board's business can be done in public and how much has to be done in private. Now, some of this is covered by the letter of law. There are things that you have to do in closed session, and there are things that you have to do in public session. So, for example, if you vote on anything that's of substance, you know, like firing someone, hiring someone, spending money, opening a new school, redistricting, all that has to be done with a public vote. And now, if it's discussing someone's personnel information, that has to be done in private. And that both of those things frustrate people. But there's a lot of gray area in between. And Star News recently had an editorial that basically just came out and said, you are erring on the side of privacy over transparency too often. And that was sort of their message to the Board of Education. And there was a recent case where they were discussing a whole slew of issues that are affecting the district right now. And all of the board members said, we feel like we obeyed the letter of the law, because Star News had accused them of potentially violating open records law. But some of the board members, including Judy Justice, also said, I would have been comfortable doing this in public. And so some of that turmoil comes from how much do you tell the public and when do you tell them?
Right. They have to adhere to the letter of the law. But you also would hope that they would strive to work for the spirit of the law, which is also about transparency and openness with the public.
Yeah, I'll give you a perfect example. So this isn't about what the board does so much as it's about personnel records, but it's all part of the same sort of code of laws. You can release parts of an employee's personnel file. So this was an issue after the arrest of Peter Michael Frank, who was a former, now fired, former Roland Grice band director. And this started sort of the recent wave of convulsions on the board.
And he's facing allegations of sexual abuse.
Yeah, about 12 felony counts of indecent liberties with children and students. And so the board actually said, we are going to consider releasing parts of his personnel file in the interest of transparency, which is something they had not done in previous cases, including Michael Earl Kelly and Nicholas LeVon Oates, who are both also former New Hanover County school employees who were also charged with child sex crimes. So the point I think Starr was trying to make, I think what a lot of the public feels, is that just because you can keep something secret, just because you can do something in a closed session, doesn't mean you have to. And I feel like there's a sense among the board members that they don't see eye to eye on when that should happen.
And there has been, it seems like, this torrent of new allegations that come to light every several days. You tweeted recently, the latest on the school system, you tweeted, again, yes, again, the school district acknowledged it had known about potential misconduct by a teacher but didn't fire them. We're running out of ways to say this politely.
We are. As a news agency, it's difficult to handle the emotional ramifications of this stuff, but especially when you're also a citizen, also a resident. Also, I don't have children, but I have friends who have children in the system. It's difficult, and there's two things going on here. One is there seemed to be a profound disconnect between the administration and the school board. So the things the administration knew about that the board could have, by law, been privy to, but weren't. And that caused some public statements that, you know, didn't have all of the information, and then you get information sort of trickling out. I think that's part of what's frustrating people.
And we're going to continue this conversation. You're listening to Coastline. Ben Schachtman of Port City Daily is with us today. We're looking at this year's primary election and which issues are sending voters to the polls. We're also answering your questions during the live Wednesday discussion. If you'd like to tell us why you're voting this year or not, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can email us at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back from this break, we'll hear from some listeners. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Election Day is March 3rd. Early voting for the 2020 primary is underway in North Carolina until Saturday, February 29th. Joining me today to take a look at the candidates, the issues, and the questions around this election is Port City Daily's managing editor, Ben Schachtman. If you have your own question about the election, or you want to tell us why you're paying attention or why you're not, give us a call during the live discussion on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Ben, I want to wrap up this discussion, if we can, about New Hanover County Public Schools and that tension that the board has been navigating publicly between what to disclose, what to keep private, how to adhere to the letter of the law when it comes to what must be not done publicly, and how they can really enhance the public discussion and dialogue and transparency. I mentioned this tweet where, you know, you said we're running out of ways to say yeah. this politely. Can you kind of sum up for us how this has arisen, the decades of personnel records
yeah.
that...
So I'll give you an example, sort of a sneak peek, a story we're working on this week, where we looked at all of the resignations between July 1st and last week when we filed our request. And we laid that on top of a list of all of the unpaid suspensions. So that's the strictest disciplinary action a school can take before they fire it. And in a case of a career teacher, like a long-term teacher, you actually have to do that before. It's like a step you have to take. And we found, just in the last couple of months, five different New Hanover County Schools employees who had been suspended without pay, and then they were allowed to resign. In one case, there was legal action was taken. There was an arrest. In another case, there may have been an arrest. We're still trying to get to the bottom of that because there may have been an alias used. In one case, we heard allegations from sources about misconduct at school with another teacher. And then two other cases, we have no idea.
When you talk about the other arrest, you know, there may have been an arrest.
Yeah.
For what?
So it was for misdemeanor larceny.
Okay.
And of course, that may be enough to impugn the character of a teacher, because there are, by state statute, I believe, 15 different reasons you can fire a tenured teacher. It does not have to be a felony sex crime. There's lots of reasons. And also, there are good reasons to fire teachers. I mean, there are, you know, that aren't, you know, salacious. There are teachers just not doing their job correctly. And there are also good reasons for teachers to resign. They get good job offers in other places. But this helps demonstrate a pattern of situations where there were clearly an issue with the teacher because they were suspended without pay. When they're suspended with pay, that's, you know, we're looking into this, but we don't know if you're guilty of the thing we're accusing you of, so we're not going to punish you financially.
Right, there's an allegation.
Right. So suspension with pay means we already have enough evidence that you've done something wrong. So, again, last couple of months, 5 employees, all suspended without pay, all resigned. If you back up and look at a larger time frame, you know, like the last 10 or 20 years, we have seen multiple cases where this has happened, where teachers have been suspended without pay and then resigned. And the problem is...
You actually reported on somebody who was accused of, again, child sex abuse, and he resigned.
Yes, this was... his name was Richard Preode. This is back in the late 1990s. He then went on to several other counties. And this is the issue we're talking about, is that when someone is not fired, it makes it easier for them to get reemployed in another district. So he moved, I believe, to Sampson County and ultimately to Charlotte, Mecklenburg, where he was arrested for having a sexual relationship with a student. So our point is that now all of this is public record. So any school district could, for any job applicant, request the, you know, do what we did, you know, request all of the suspensions, request a job history. That's, you know, if you're a district with thousands of employees, that's a complicated, time-consuming process. This kind of thing doesn't show up on a background check, you know. So the point is that when...
And can you... I think that's confusing for some people.
Yeah.
So can you explain why it wouldn't?
Sure. So background checks tend to show convictions, right? They sometimes will show arrests, sometimes not. Again, all this stuff is public record, but most... school districts use a third-party background check company. And so depending on how much time and energy and money you spend, you get varying degrees of information. The key part for this is that when someone resigns, nothing prevents the school system from giving them a recommendation. So even if the administration fired you, you could still get a recommendation from a principal who liked you or a fellow teacher who liked you. And it effectively closes the door on what happened to you during your time at that particular district. So what we see is, you know, in several cases, is teachers moving from county to county. They have incidents. They come to the level of being suspended without pay. They never cross the line into a criminal conviction or being fired. And so I think that's part of what concerns people, is that obviously you need a balance between people's personal privacy and the state law that actually gives you those privacy rights as an employee, and, you know, a system that seems to let people fall through the cracks. So that's the balance that people are looking for, and I think that seems out of balance right now.
Jamie writes, Rachel and Ben, I voted yesterday. I was thrilled to be able to vote for strong, intelligent, capable women for many positions. She says, I did laborious research online, spoke at length with an intelligent, well-informed friend, and ultimately looked at the slate provided by Women Organizing for Wilmington for guidance. She says, Ben, I'm an annual subscriber. Keep up the good work.
Thanks. You very much.
Thanks for writing in, Jamie. And George wrote in with a question. He says, how can I print out a sample ballot of the upcoming election? And I think this is a question a lot of people have, and it's really, really simple. You can go to your county board of elections page or go to the state board of elections voter search page. You just enter your last name, your first name, voter status, click search. And you'll find your name. The system displays all your information, including your precinct, and it'll give you an option for downloading your sample ballot. If you have any trouble with that, send an email to coastline@whqr.org or get in touch with your county board of elections. What are the biggest surprises so far in terms of the races that are contested in the primary for you, Ben Schachtman?
So there's two that have surprised me. One is the amount of interest in the Register of Deeds position. One, because you don't think of it as being a particularly, you know, partisan activity. It's largely clerical. Almost all of the achievements of the Register of Deeds office over the last 10 years have been in terms of things I think both parties would agree on. You know, you want a system that's accessible, that's inexpensive, and that seems to be... So I do think it's... Especially because it's so expensive to run for. The filing fee for a Register of Deeds is over $900. It's very expensive, in part because it's a paid position, I believe.
Okay, put that in perspective for us.
Yeah.
Compare that to, say, the filing fee for a county commissioner. If you don't have it at hand.
I don't have it. I believe it's a couple hundred bucks.
Right.
It's significantly larger. State Senate and Register of Deeds are two of the more expensive ones. And so one of the things we're doing, we don't have all the interviews together yet, but we wanted to talk to, because there's four people running, two from the Republican Party, one from the Democrat Party, and one from the Green Party, I believe. And just sort of curious, you know, how politics plays into what is, in essence, a very important but still a clerical position. So that's one. So stay tuned for that. The other has been District 19, which, as you guys have reported on, looks totally different this year than it did last year after North Carolina's redistricting. So now it used to be the lower part of New Hanover County, Carolina Beach, Curie Beach, and the southern part of New Hanover County. And now it covers a huge swath of Brunswick County beach areas. So we've got new issues. We've got new candidates. And also just a really interesting, you know, kind of district to wrap your head around what it looks like, because it's a lot of different communities now.
And I think this can get really confusing for voters, because House District 19, historically, at least for the last at least four terms, has been... incumbent Ted Davis, who's a Republican from New Hanover County. We're talking about State House District 19. And he is running again, but he is actually running now in House District 20 because the districts have flipped with the new maps. So he's running for House District 20, and he is challenged by Justin Lanassa, who is... someone who's run for many different offices over the years, and we actually interviewed both of those Republican candidates. And you've actually seen Justin Lanassa's campaigns.
I have. So he ran for mayor. I believe he ran. I believe he ran for representative before. He is cantankerous. It's interesting to see, too. I could not be more different than Ted Davis. Let's put it that way. In terms of his approach to things, I think when you guys interviewed him and when I've spoken with him, he's largely unimpressed with the General Assembly, usually has kind of disparaging things to say about their track record in terms of effectiveness. Whereas Ted Davis, prides himself on being sort of a legacy senior statesman in the General Assembly. And so Davis's argument is kind of, you know, I know the ropes. I know the people I'll have to work with. I can build consensus with people across the aisle. And although if you push Davis, he will admit, you know, it is difficult to get anything done in the General Assembly. He once called it a fire hose to the face in terms of just the sheer amount of information and legislation that comes at you. But he prides himself on being able to get stuff done, whereas Lanassa has always said, at least my conversations with him, that it's just kind of, you know, it's a bureaucracy. You know, it's an ineffective way to do things. So it's interesting to see where those two will go with it.
Yeah. And, of course, Ted Davis likes to use the fact that he's been in office now. I'm not sure if this is he's completing his fourth term. But he's been in office for a number of years, and that actually matters in Raleigh in terms of being able to navigate policy relationships and getting things done.
Yeah, it's a sticky point, because you want to treat every election fairly, and you don't want to automatically give someone credit just because they're the incumbent. And I think it's fair to say that as the incumbent, you kind of have to answer for what you have and haven't done in your previous terms. But if you ask anyone who's been to Raleigh, what junior elected officials usually do for the first 2 years is sit quietly and watch. So it doesn't mean that someone can't bust in there and get things done, but usually you take a back seat and just try to wrap your head around the process first. So people who come in and say, you know, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z in my first 2 years often have to eat crow later.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a primary 2020 preview. Early voting is underway in North Carolina. We're taking a look at the issues that are driving voters to the polls this year and some of the more interesting races that are on the ballot in the primary. Ben Schachtman, managing editor of Port City Daily, is with me today. You can ask your own question or tell us how you're handling or not handling the election this March during the live Wednesday discussion by calling us at 910-343-1138 or by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. Henry from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just want to kind of break through the fourth wall a little bit here in this conversation and highlight how incredibly important Ben's work has been. It's not an exaggeration to say that local reporting, particularly investigative reporting, is on life support in this country. And I really think that some of the issues, myriad issues, school board and otherwise, are actually enabled by the fact that folks know that there just simply isn't in-depth investigation going on in local municipalities anymore. And I want to thank Ben for his work and just, like I said, really point out how it's all interrelated. I mean, you know, the fourth estate is supposed to be another check and balance on our government. And with, you know, the mega mergers and takeovers, it's just simply dying. So nice work, Ben.
Thanks for that, Henry. Let me ask you, are you voting in the primary this year?
Yeah, I personally vote in every election. I don't think I've missed one in 22 years. Obviously, there are some stark local, state, and federal things on the line in this election.
What do you think the biggest local issue on the line is facing voters this election cycle?
I think that for local folks, I would say it is most certainly the housing affordability issue in Wilmington. For local voters, I think it's tougher to say. Notice I separated the two because, you know, depending on who actually turns out to vote. But I you know, on the street, I think far and away it is the you know, lack of affordable housing in our area.
Yeah.
You know, and sad to say, I don't see too many folks addressing, you know, with concrete plans to address that. But and then I think the hospital sale is a very close second. Yeah. I think that most of us see that as being incredibly shady.
Well, Henry, thank you so much for your call. I have to say that WHQR shares that sentiment when it comes to the work that Ben and all the good folks over at Port City Daily do. It is really important. And investigative journalism, the kind of stuff that you do is expensive and it's hard to do because you don't come out with a payoff every single day. So it can be hard to justify in the smaller newsrooms.
It can, but Henry, we really appreciate that. Thank you so much.
You know, water quality is affecting all of the counties in southeastern North Carolina, and it's something that's on the minds of a lot of people just on social media. I've seen people talking about, you know, vote this year, use your voice to help our water quality. But what does that really mean? How is this election going to translate into the way people vote on water quality? That's not really a partisan issue, is it?
Not at the very local level. I mean, we could go down a whole rabbit hole of what happened in the General Assembly over the last couple of years with various funding packages, either for the university system or for the DEQ. And we did have those questions for our state reps. But at the local level, I think there's been pretty wide, broad consensus on, you know, two main things. One is increasing filtration methods, whether or not you went with granulated activated carbon or reverse osmosis. Both New Hanover County and Brunswick County had pretty ambitious plans to up their treatment game that came pretty quickly after Gen X. The other thing is that both of those are kind of predicated on ultimately some kind of civil suit against Chemours in federal court, which is a very long process. So one, the people we vote for now might not even be in office by the time a federal suit ends. And two, I think most of the infrastructure decisions that you would see a county commissioner have already kind of been made and are, in some cases, construction's already underway. For state reps, it's a different story.
Right. I actually heard from one candidate, and this will air later this week, who talked about, this is a candidate for local office at the county level, and talked about getting a list of vendors, you know, the procurement list, who do we use, and let's not use people who make the PFAS that goes into the water supply, which I thought was an interesting distinction. Let's talk about House District. We talked about House District 19, which is becoming House District 20, in a sense. And then there's House District 19,
right,
which has some interesting races. That's on the Democratic side. It's Marsha Morgan and James Dawkins. And both our organizations have talked to those folks. What have you learned about that race?
So, again, I think we talked a little bit this off microphones. It's two different kinds of progressive Democrats. So if you're not a progressive Democrat, that means nothing to you. But I think, you know, Marsha Morgan, who ran, I believe both candidates actually ran 2 years ago. But, you know, Morgan has, in her conversations with me, said, yes, you know, she is, she's a progressive leftist, but she's also willing to work with, you know, some of the people in the Republican establishment. She, in my conversation, she told me about her career in the military, which was, you know, built on a foundation of doing very difficult tasks in concert with people who didn't necessarily like you.
Right.
That was sort of her pitch, to her elevator pitch to me.
She talks about it in a, you know, in a, the idea that you have to work with everybody.
You have the
and
choice.
You need to find a way through that. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas in my conversations with Dawkins, he's been much more outspoken about, you know, almost a moral imperative to not concede to conservative ideologues in the General Assembly.
He told us he wouldn't even work with them.
Right.
And I don't, he didn't even say conservative ideologues. He said Republicans.
Sure. So basically it boils down to, you know, do you go out on a limb for someone who's really going to go hard and left fight, or maybe someone who will occasionally make concessions and try to get stuff done? So
you're listening to Coastline. It's primary 2020 election preview with Port City Daily's Ben Schachtman. Tell us what's on your mind this election year and whether you're voting in the primary and what does voting in the primary mean to you. You can call us during the live show on Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. After the break, it's the last segment, just a few minutes left to get your question in. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's a preview of primary 2020 in North Carolina. Early voting is underway through February 29th. Election day is March 3rd. It's an earlier primary this year. They've typically been held in May, but no voter ID is required to vote. It's unlikely that will change by November, although that is still technically an open question. Ben Schachtman of Port City Daily is with me today. If you have a question about the election or if you'd like to tell us why you're voting or not voting in this primary, call us during the live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. It's the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. And just before we went to break, Ben, we'd taken a look at the new House District 19 in North Carolina and talked about the Democratic candidates. There is also a primary race on the Republican side, and you've talked to both of those people.
Yes. So we spoke briefly with Charles Miller, and David Perry is his candidate. And I think this is an interesting race because as much as Dawkins and Morgan's are very different kinds of Democrats, these are very different kinds of Republicans.
One is in Wilmington, one is in Southport.
Yeah, so they're coming from different aspects. And, of course, David Perry was formerly a Libertarian candidate who ran against Morgan and Ted Davis 2 years ago. And Miller is actually a former Democrat. He was on he was in the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office. And so they're both coming from sort of outside of the party. Over the last 10 years, they have sort of ended up in the Republican Party, which is not necessarily a negative thing. People change their minds, demographics change, you know, people see themselves in the ideological spectrum in different places. But it's worth pointing out that they have kind of different takes on what the Republican Party means and what it's doing. Perry still has a lot of those libertarian leanings. For example, he suggested things like, if not dissolving, then radically stripping back the Department of Transportation and giving the county the power to build roads, which is something by statute counties can't do right now. County staff and commissioners take a lot of flack for not doing road improvements, but by law they can't do it. So that was a suggestion he made. Or if you look at something like the DEQ. So traditionally in the General Assembly...
Department of Environmental Quality.
Yes,
just
very
for,
sorry.
I have to do that.
Yes, I know. I'm sorry.
That's
so
all right.
The DEQ historically has been supported by Democrats and Republicans. When they're not accusing it of mismanagement, have at least said, you know, no more funding increases for DEQ. That's kind of the line that Charles Miller took, saying...
Which has been a partisan battle, as you alluded to in the last segment, about water quality and how to deal with it. The Republicans voting to fund the Collaboratory, which is the UNC-based research and policy development. And then there's DEQ, which is the actual enforcement agency.
Yes, exactly. So Miller suggested that no, you know, DEQ was funded adequately. It just needs to be run more effectively. Whereas Perry said, I would consider, you know, increasing their funding. So they're both Republican candidates. It's worth looking at what they had to say because they reflect, you know, different aspects of how Republicans are approaching state level and local issues.
Okay, now we need to circle back to New Hanover County Public Schools because there's an element of that problem that we're wrestling with both internally and externally, I think. And you have characterized it, as have we here, as being careful about it becoming a witch hunt.
Yeah, we started talking about this in our newsroom at a certain point where we started getting complaints that seemed vindictive, mm-hmm. Which I think is only one part of it. But I think it's easy to be frustrated and understandably frustrated with the Board of Education or the administration when they don't release information. But there are laws that protect these people. And it's worth pointing out, for example, that you know, someone like Peter Michael Frank has not been tried in a court of law. He has not been convicted. There is some damning evidence. He has already admitted things to the authorities that the school board could and did ultimately use to terminate his contract. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. There are dozens of other investigations going on right now by the sheriff's office. A lot of those, you know, we get emails from those parents or those students who notify us that they've filed complaints. And some of these are very serious and will probably end up with, you know, an arrest and a prosecution that will be public. Some of them aren't. You know, some of these are based on what appeared to be personal grudges. Some of these are based on misinformation, on rumor, on gossip. And it's very easy to, at this point, to no longer believe the administration has any, you know, ability to properly vet and investigate. It's even reasonable to at least discuss suspicions that the sheriff's office hasn't handled all of these cases adequately, that they have failed to press charges when they probably could have, the Nicholas Oates case being, you know, the prime example. But that doesn't mean that, you know, every allegation, that every email we get, that every rumor you see on Facebook is, you know, is what actually happened. And I think there is a level of, you know, frustration and anger that can tip over into just automatically believing that every person who is accused of something is in fact guilty.
As we mentioned earlier, the New Hanover County Board of Commissioners race is massive. There are 15 candidates in all. 6 of them are Democrats. 9 of them are Republicans. There are 3 open seats, Ben Shachtman. Only one incumbent is running on the Democratic side, and that's Jonathan Barfield.
Yes, I believe will become the longest serving commissioner if he wins.
How many years would it be, do you know?
I think he would end up having served 16. He's already the senior member, but he would be, I think it would be 16 years. But in any case, yeah, it is a crowded house. So we've had a chance to talk to almost all of them. We almost by default had to go with a questionnaire format because we couldn't do an hour-long conversation with 16 people. We do hope to do, you know, a follow-up after the primaries, but we've had a chance to ask them at least about the big issues and to ask them what they see as the issues.
And, of course, we're seeing a former commissioner, Skip Watkins, running on the Republican side. It's interesting. Jonathan Barfield was also recently pushed aside on the WAVE Transit Board. The most recent County Board of Commissioners meeting, there was in, I think, at the very end of the meeting, our favorite section now, additional items.
Yes, it's a potpourri of surprises.
Actually, that may not be true. I might need to correct that. I think this actually was an agenda item on the new Hanover County Board of Commissioners.
But that said, the additional items is still my favorite.
Yes, and there were some things that popped this time.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the WAVE Transit Board and what's happening there.
Sure. So there was, you know, it's no secret that WAVE was in trouble financially, and this is my personal opinion, so I want to make that clear. This is not the opinion of Port City Daily. But it seemed like the difficulties of WAVE turned into a political issue in a way that was kind of removed from the actual mechanics of it. And by that I mean for people who supported WAVE, which largely seemed to be the more liberal democratic side of the town, WAVE became kind of an article of faith, a sacred cow, right? So anything criticizing WAVE was seen as wrong, and anything defending WAVE was good, and that kind of overlooked the fact that as someone who used to work in the service industry and relied on WAVE, WAVE failed a lot of people. It failed to do what it was supposed to do. And now part of that is institutional. It was never given clear guidance on what it was supposed to be. It was sort of living with one foot in two worlds. Part coverage model, part convenience model. But it's hard to not see this as a little bit political when Jonathan Barfield, who's been very proud of public transit, is kicked off the board along with the rest of the board. And then Woody White, who he has sparred with many times, is his replacement, basically.
And it was an interesting dynamic. And it's one that we've seen now in a number of county commission meetings where there's a motion made. And in this case, it was Chair Julia Olson Bozeman who moved to put Woody White on the WAVE board. There was a quick second. And then Commissioner Rob Zappel tried to jump in and initiate some discussion about it. And there was and Julia Olson Bozeman just called the question, which means taking it to a vote.
Yes.
There was some very clear resistance to having a discussion. Now, on one hand, you can argue if a commissioner thinks that this is the right way forward and we're wasting time if we have discussion. On the other hand, there's just this thing, you know, people elected Rob Zappel and Jonathan Barfield to the New Hanover County Board of Commissioners, and even if there's a majority on the board that wants to move in a certain direction, isn't discussion always healthy? And are you observing this appearance of not only a lack of interest in discussion, but an active attempt to quash discussion at the public level?
So I think there's always a need to find a balance between active discussion and political theatrics. And we see it all the time. We'll see a council member will vote noting that it's purely symbolic, or he'll make a statement or she'll make a statement against a certain motion and then vote for it. But in this case, it seemed like the hammer came down too fast. I think part of the issue is that the county commission has done away with agenda briefings, which for some people were boring, arcane, bureaucratic procedures. But what they did is they were usually held, I believe, the Thursday before, and they gave the commissioners and staff a chance to work through issues, and it was a place that was almost specifically designed for public discussion. And if you're the kind of person who wants there to be kind of a quick pace to, you know, these official public meetings where all the votes are taken, that's fine. And I think there's something to be said for cutting down on the amount of grandstanding in you know, public office. But those agenda meetings gave a safe space for discussion where you knew nothing was going to get voted on. So the whole point of having discussion was for discussion's sake. So with those eliminated, it's become, the onus is now on those, for the county commissioners, for those Monday meetings, right? For the sole meeting that they have to really get into the issues. And if you're going to rush through them, you're going to lose out on the chance. Now, obviously, I think for this one, I think it was a done deal. I think anyone watching this on either side of the political spectrum could say it's pretty clear that Cusack, White, and Olson Bozeman were going to vote one way and that Zappel and Barfield were going to vote the other way. So an hour-long speech would probably be pointless. But to have no discussion seems undemocratic.
There was also an item dropped into additional items at the end that was about funding for New Hanover County Schools, and this passed unanimously. Can you tell us what that was? Because this is about helping the schools deal with their problem.
Yes, and I don't have the exact amount of money in front of me, but I think what's important to understand is that this was the county offered a couple weeks ago. Basically, we are at your disposal. The school board only has so much in their budget. The county has a little bit more liquidity, has the ability to move money around a little bit more. There's two things going on. One, there are things going forward that the school board wanted to do, including surveillance methods. I'm talking about like cameras and stuff like that, additional staff, Title IX investigators that cost money that the school board didn't have. And the county was basically saying, we will write you a check and you can cover that. The other part of this, and you have to read between the lines a little bit, is that part of the money went to Dr. Markley's separation. That's former Superintendent Dr. Tim Markley.
Who resigned under the terms of a separation agreement.
Right. And it would be foolhardy to believe that that was an amicable parting. Obviously, the school board wanted him gone or they would not have paid $250,000 to see it happen.
Right.
But they didn't have the money. So first they signed the separation agreement with him. And then the county provided the money.
Right.
So if you know anything about the way government works, you cannot vote for something you cannot afford. That is, one, it's against the law, and two, it's just not the way government works. If there's no money, you can't do it. So it seems to me very reasonable to say that there had been at least some conversation with the county. Hey, if we need additional funding to end our relationship with Dr. Markley, to end this chapter at the schools, will you come through and write us a check?
And Chair Olson Bozeman actually suggested that.
Pretty much.
Mentioned a phone call with school board chair Lisa Estep.
Yeah.
And said, we will help you in anything that you need. That total was just under $360,000.
Yes.
And they did say that. Yes, it was partly for the separation agreement for Markley, partly for two Title IX investigators. There were also questions just about whether those would be permanent positions, and that discussion was again kind of...
I saw this reported as permanent positions. It's my understanding that they will be hired as permanent positions contingent on future funding. Given the amount of public outcry over this issue, given the apparent lapses of the Title IX system they have now, even with their new Title IX director, I can't see there being too much public resistance to making those continuing. But again, it's something that wasn't really fully discussed.
Okay, election related, I have to mention this question from Leslie. What advice do you have finding info on candidates like Lieutenant Governor or North Carolina Auditor? I found and watched interviews with commissioners, House of Representatives candidates, but finding less info on these other positions. That's a really good question, Leslie.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're somewhat limited. We can only cover so much ground. One of the things that's always frustrated us is that we rarely have the resources to cover state-level offices or even judgeships that cover multiple counties like that.
That's our frustration as well.
Yeah, it's something we hope to tackle in the future, but right now, you have my sympathy. It's tough.
New Hanover Regional Medical Center, that is an evolving conversation, and it's certainly something that local candidates are engaged in. The Partnership Advisory Group is charged with finding the best way forward. There are questions among members of the public, and the Partnership Advisory Group is now running TV ads to say, hey, we are doing this in the most democratic, transparent way possible. But what's the latest on that, and how is this shaping?
Sure. So right now the PAG is considering, and there's been some contention there, but they're considering options for what it would mean to keep the hospital independent. And that's essentially what they're doing while they're waiting for the proposals to come back from the institutions that they sent the RFPs to. One of the issues that we had was one of the main suggestions is something called SystemCo, and I don't want to get into all the details because I know we're short on time. But it's basically a restructuring that would let them tackle some of the issues. So the PAG is now reviewing that option. But this is something that's already come up and already effectively been shot down by commissioners as not being able to cover all of the problems that the hospital will face in the future. So I got to leave it there. But it seems like if people are skeptical, I don't blame them.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Early voting in place through February 29th. That's a Saturday. Election day is March 3rd. Ben Shockman of Port City Daily, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Coastline's production team is led by Rachel Keith and includes Ken Campbell and Marissa Castrino. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org, on the app, or get the podcast. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.